All right, this is Dobsound.com, wiretaps. Our guest today is Matt Maurer. That's spelled M-A-U-R-E-R. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay, let's begin with how we met. I'm walking regularly on the beach walkway before the hotels in Wailea on the island of Maui. And I keep bumping into this woman, and I get to know her, and then she introduces me to her friend, and that turns out to be you, Matt, and it turns out you have an interesting history in the music business. And that's why I thought this should be documented, because I like that kind of doo-wop R&B stuff that you began in, and we feature that on Dobsound.com in our Noah's Ark section. So, Matt, were you born in New York City?
I was born in the Bronx.
Now, this would be in the 30s?
No, in the 40s.
Okay. You want to give an exact date, or you want to keep that?
Of course, I could give an exact date, 1941. I just won't tell you the day, that's all.
All right. So 1941, in my mind, that's the year Bob Dylan was born, Don Van Vliet, known as Captain Beefheart, Zappa was born in December 40, Lennon is born, John Lennon's born in 1940. A lot of great musicians of the baby boomer period, or for baby boomers, the people that produced the music, was born in that period. So, were you in your domestic upbringing groomed to be a musician? Were you trained in any way?
Yes, I was. Basically, the way it happened, and this is one of the clearest memories I have, when I was, I guess it's 9 years old, I walk in my house, and my brother is taking a piano lesson. I look down at him, and I look at my mother, and I say, "Can I try that?" She looks at me, she smiles, and she said, "Well, let's ask the teacher, after he's finished with your brother's lesson, whether he's got time." And sure enough, he was able to spend an extra 10 minutes. And in those 10 minutes, and this is as true as it gets, I, at that moment, realized that's all I truly wanted.
Well, were you able to play?
No, I was not able to play. But the very fact of what this teacher had done just in the few minutes made me realize that I wanted to play.
Okay, now is your brother younger?
No, he's 5.5 years old.
Okay, so you want to do that. So you start taking lessons.
Correct. I take lessons, and I have never wanted to do anything any more or any harder than I wanted to do that. And I couldn't learn quick enough. And so by the time, just before my 14th birthday, I got into a band and was able to go away for 2 months during the summer. It wasn't the Catskills, it was further up than the Catskill Mountains, which was a famous area for, you know, vacationing and things like that.
Yeah.
And so I played with this four-piece band, and that was actually my very, very first job in the mountains, so to speak. And from there, I just kept on going.
Okay, so, you know, when you say you want to play, when I played baseball, I wanted to play baseball again, so to speak. You know, I wanted to do it. But I think you mean something different. You're thinking about, well, I know I have to be somebody and do a job or something. You meant that you said, I'm going to do this to make money. Is that how you, what you mean?
No, I never really, I didn't, you know, actuate that part of it to myself. I never thought in terms of, well, I'm going to do this to make money. Number one, I was, you know, 9 years old. And so I think what I kept thinking about that is I hope my father continues making money.
You mean you just said, I'm going to keep doing this every day. I don't have to be told to do it. I'm going to do it anyway.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, when I got into lessons, and this is something that I have since, I mean, I found out pretty early on, kids, and there were lots of kids in my apartment building growing up, and a lot of them, you know, also took piano lessons, but nobody actually continued with the exception of myself. and my brother. And they always had to be forced to practice. For me, practicing was the great escape, and was something that, till today, blocks everything else out.
Right.
So it's not only enjoyment, it's also a kind of meditation. There's a lot of levels to it, you know, from a, I guess from a psychological point of view.
Right. Okay, so when you start, in this, this be 1950, are you taught classical music first? What is the guy teaching you?
That's exactly right. To begin with, what he taught me was theory, and along with theory, he also made it palatable, so here I am playing these little ditzy type of things.
Yes.
But with these little ditzy type of things, I'm also playing a book known as, and the composer was a man by the name of Czerny, spelled C-Z-E-R-N-Y. And what Czerny did was he kind of wrote the book on exercises, difficult piano exercises.
Okay, so was your teacher impressed at your speed of learning, or were you just normal?
Well, so much so that I was only with him and nobody else, actually, after 5 years, when he said to me, I can't teach you anymore. You probably can teach me.
Wow, and that's by the time you're 14.
Right.
Okay, I'm curious about how does one go from classical training to being on the street corner singing doo-wop. Now, before you answer that directly, are you hearing the radio when you're nine?
When I'm nine, I guess I'm hearing the radio a little bit. I don't know. That's a good question, and I can't really truthfully remember.
In other words, it isn't hit parade time yet for young kids. That's in the 50s.
Well, it's starting because at that point, Bill Haley is coming around, but not quite at 50.
Yeah, he's 54. He's 54,
yeah,
55.
Right, right. So that's probably true where I was listening more. So I wouldn't really be able to say that music outside of myself was, you know, the instrumental force.
Well, did your parents play records? Did you have...
My mother was actually... an entertainer who was not allowed to be on the stage because her parents were very, very religious, and they were unhappy with the fact that skirts were so short. And so, anyway, she had a glorious voice. My father was a homegrown, self-made harmonica player.
Okay.
And he would bring that out. Matter of fact, I've got that exact harmonica right here. So from here, we can go over to eBay. Anyway, he would take it out at birthday parties and stuff like that.
So you would experience them singing in the home?
Yes, my mother would always be singing in the home.
What would she sing?
The best description of the voice she had would be she could have done Broadway.
So she sang Broadway stuff of that period, too.
Yeah, her favorite song was, I believe her favorite song was, I've got a... the title of the song, I know the song, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, oh, what a beautiful morning. That's it, oh, what a beautiful morning.
Oh, okay.
It comes from a show, as a matter of fact. I think it's a Rodgers and Hammerstein song. But anyway, she would sing what I would call, you know, Broadway-type music.
Okay, but you're staying in your building, and what is the address of this building?
The address?
Yeah, in Bronx.
1420 Clay Avenue.
Clay Avenue. I know the Bronx a little bit.
And it still exists because a friend of mine, who I keep in contact with, actually sent me a file, an attached file, showing the renovation of the building. However, the neighborhood is so dangerous, or at least I was told that as good as the building looks, that's as tough as the neighborhood is.
Right. And so what subway stop is it near your building?
It's the D train. would have been the stop, and it would have been the 170th Street stop on the subway.
On the D train.
That's right. Going from the Bronx to Manhattan.
Right. Okay. So in this building, is everybody being forced to play music? It's just what kids are taught in that period?
Quite a few.
Right. And their parents weren't necessarily musicians or musically
true. Not
talented.
Exactly.
Okay. So is this, you meet these people when you're 14 and it's a band. What kind of music, what kind of instruments?
It was a quartet. It was bass, piano. No, I'm sorry. Wrong. It was piano, drums, trumpet, saxophone.
And you're on the piano.
Correct.
So how did you get scouted? Why were you with this band?
What happened was I paid a visit to the Musicians Union on a Wednesday, and Wednesdays were the day when there would be this huge meeting which took place. Have you ever heard of Roseland?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Roseland.
It used to be a big dance hall where, you know, big orchestras anywhere from Duke Ellington and the likes would play, and people went to dance. Well, every Wednesday, they would mat the floor, and they would have what they call bookers and contractors. And I went down there, and I made a connection with a particular man. I remember his first name, and his name was Lee. And what's so interesting is, and he was the leader, and he actually took a chance on me. I talked to him for a while, and he said, I've got this job coming up, blah, blah, blah. And okay. And what's so interesting about Lee is that he was the trumpet player, and on his lower lip was the hugest mole you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, how is this man going to play the trumpet? Well, he played the trumpet, but the best way I can describe the humor of this is that every once in a while, it would be as if the trumpet stuttered.
What's that mean? Oh, stuttered?
Yeah. Because he would, like, you know, kind of screw up and miss the note, or the mole would hit the mouthpiece. And, I mean, there were times where, I mean, I had to really, really force myself to hold in
right.
the laughter. Anyway, so that was the gist of it, where he just decided to give me this shot. And
but you're not a member of the union yet, right?
I was not a member. And this was not, that was the good news, was not a union job. But anybody was allowed to walk in there on Wednesdays and congregate. And so that's where he went, so that he could talk to different people and see, apparently, you know, himself putting on this band together.
Right. So you're smooth. Everybody goes there and they call it smoozing now. So you would be just mingling and seeing who you could connect with.
That's exactly right.
And so you got talking to him. You say you can play the piano. He needs a pianist. He says, what can you play? Now, what kind of music did you play in that performance?
Everything from Blue Moon to a song called I'm Gonna Live Till I Die. I'm gonna laugh, stare, or cry. I'm gonna take the town and turn it upside down. I'm gonna live, live, live until I die. So there's that. Then there is show tunes. I have often walked down the street before, and that's from My Fair Lady.
Now, you knew this stuff before you walked in.
Well, I didn't know it all.
Yeah.
And so I actually had some books, and what I did invest in pretty quickly, and, you know, I virtually have the original right here from the day I'm 14, is what they call a fake book. Are you familiar with that term?
I've heard it, but I don't know how you apply it.
Okay, well, a fake book is a book of 1,000, 2,000 tunes, and they put 3 on a page. It's very, very small music. It has the basic melody line. It has the basic, very basic chord harmonic line. And it has, in most cases, the lyrics to each of the songs.
Why do they call it a fake book?
A fake book because it's really, everything is abbreviated.
Oh, okay.
And so it's kind of, well, I guess the next best thing would be is like a what do they call that? A cheating
Coles note.
A gyp sheet.
Yeah, yeah. It's a an outline, an incomplete.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of times the chords should be extended more, or there should be several more added, but they don't.
Right.
Yeah, so it's done very quickly, and as I said, there are literally three songs to an 8x10 page.
Mm.
Now, if you've ever looked at a piece of sheet music, that you don't get three songs, you get one,
yeah.
And you get them on several pages.
Right. I said Coles notes, that's Canadian. Cliff notes, I think, is what Americans call it. Summaries of books and novels, you know, that kids would use when they wrote papers.
Right.
Anyway, so you knew a few things. You knew a bit of showbiz, not just classical music, so you could learn whatever he taught you. Did you guys rehearse?
A little bit.
And so it was a few weeks before you went up.
Yeah, it might have even been a couple months before.
Oh, okay. Is the Catskills in the Adirondacks?
No, that's totally separate. The Catskills are approximately 100 miles north of New York City.
Right. Now, I know where they are. Is the Adirondacks near there?
No, not at all. Hmm. The Adirondacks are near Lake Placid, which is the the western part of the...
Oh, okay. All right. So what are the mountain range? They're just called the Catskills. That's the range.
Yeah, that's it.
And then the Appalachians is south of that.
Correct.
Okay. So here you are, you go and you do this. How many gigs did you do, one night or a week?
No, that was for a hotel, and it was called the Lake Huntington Lodge, and it was the whole summer.
Oh.
And it's every night, and we played, that I would say might be a stretch as to the hours, but I believe we started at 8 in the evening. It might have even been a half an hour later, and it usually went for about 3 or 4 hours.
With a couple of breaks.
With a couple of breaks, and then at that time, I'm trying to think, there used to be one, maybe more, I'm not sure, what they call outside shows. Somebody would be hired from outside, like a singer, a comedian, a dancer. They would come in the afternoon of that day that they're going to play, let's say a Saturday night, and they would come in with music. And we would rehearse usually somewhere about 3-4 in the afternoon and go for basically until they were kind of satisfied with the music. And sometimes it was okay and sometimes it was not very good, because sometimes the parts, especially for sax and trumpet, were more difficult than the level of skill that the people had playing it.
Yeah, I'm not, okay, you're saying the afternoon, what are these, comedians who come and audition? Is that what you're saying?
Not audition. They came to rehearse us so that we would get the music right at night.
For them?
Yeah.
Rehearse with them.
Right.
And you're saying what wasn't right sometimes?
Sometimes it didn't come off all that great. Lots of mistakes.
So this was incredible for a 14-year-old. Must have been a great summer. You get paid enough to live? I mean, what did they pay you?
My first job, $40, room and board.
Well, that's great.
Yep, that was fine by me, and all the girls I could meet.
That's right. I'm thinking that you've got all summer, and all these girls coming through, you got a bit of charisma because you're part of the band. You must have started to become a lover then.
I remember right this minute the name of the first girl that I spent that summer with.
What's her name?
Barbara Gleichenhaus. How's that? And she wore only, and that, I don't know, was somewhat of a turn-on, she wore only jeans outfits. And when I say jeans outfits, I mean the whole thing was jeans, like pants, shirt, jacket, that sort of thing. I was even surprised that her name wasn't Jean. You know?
Right, but people didn't wear jeans like that back then, did they?
Yeah, they did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is 1950. I keep thinking it's the 40s. No, it's 1950.
Well, it's more than that. Remember, it's 1955.
Oh, yeah, what am I thinking? Right. So, now, It's 1955. Are you hearing rock and roll right when it starts? So you're near a radio.
I'm definitely hearing, you know, Bill Haley and the Comets.
Right. They were before Elvis.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely hearing rhythm and blues. I'm definitely hearing, if you're so smart, how come you ain't rich? That was Louis Jordan and the Jordanaires.
Right. They were, they're sometimes considered the first rock and roll band.
They're amongst one.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of groups, hard to know who was really the first, but yeah.
Okay, so you're playing with this older guy, and it's not rock and roll, it's show tunes.
Yeah, it's basically standards, is what you call Blue Moon, Sentimental Journey, let's say The Lady is a Tramp, you know, stuff like that. Those are called standards and show music.
Ringo Starr stuff.
And we're playing Latin music, we're playing some rumbas, playing some tangos. We're playing even a paso doble.
What's that?
A paso doble is a very quick two-step. Ba 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 bum, ba ba bum bum bum, bum ba bum ba 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 ba.
Right.
Something like that.
Did you hear what I said?
No.
When you were first saying the standard sentimental, I said Ringo Starr stuff.
Well, yeah, actually, I guess he did.
He did that when he had to go solo when the Beatles broke up.
Right, right. And if you remember, who was it? Also, Rod Stewart suddenly did an album of standards. And there's a lot of them out there that suddenly said, hey, there are some good songs out there that are better than, let's face it, I mean, than the bubblegum that is out there.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're hearing rock and roll, you have classical training, you're playing in a band. Are you thinking of not being a classical musician?
I don't believe that thought actually went through my mind.
So you're already thinking of entertainment industry, Broadway or something?
Yeah, I'm thinking of that I'm this musician who's got some talent and I can play and I also sing, so I had that as an asset. And I just want to be working at my craft. And
what about jazz?
Absolutely.
So you're listening to jazz?
Absolutely, yeah. As a matter of fact, at that time, my first influence, jazz-wise, definitely was Dave Brubeck.
Okay.
I actually bought a book specifically to listen to that. And, of course, then there's the... there's all the recordings that he made at that time, and so so very much into that.
Yeah, I know. I think Brubeck, he was the musician of choice for college kids if they weren't going with the mainstream music.
Brubeck,
he was popular in college. He might have been the first guy to be big in college, unless that was the case in the 30s. I don't know, but I remember people talking about the 50s, being at school and hearing Brubeck.
Yeah,
yeah.
He just turned 90.
Okay, he's still alive. All right.
Yeah, he is. They gave him the Kennedy honor back, I don't know, within a year ago, something like that, year and a half ago.
So what did you think of Bill Haley? Was that a shock, or just you loved it, or you thought it was stupid? What did you think of rock and roll?
I don't know that I had a big opinion of it. I'm thinking that there were some tunes that I really liked. I mean, and funny, I actually heard it the other day. Percy Faith, Blue Tango.
Yeah.
I heard that, and I remember liking that song. I remember liking a song called Wheel of Fortune by K-Star.
Yeah.
And there were a few songs, Ghost Riders in the Sky, Vaughn Monroe.
Right. Okay, yeah. So you're listening to that, and you do this thing when you're 14. Does that lead to other gigs?
Oh, yeah. I never stopped working after that.
So did you leave school?
No, I went all the way through college.
Oh, so you're going to school while working at night in whatever bands.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so now you say you were a good singer, talented singer. How do you get on the street corner?
How do I get, well, wait a minute, when you say street corner, how do you mean that?
Well, you know, the famous doo-wop street corner singing that starts in the Bronx, in that area.
Well, no, for me it didn't start anywhere in the Bronx. What happened was one summer, and I'm trying to nail it down, I guess it was probably 1960 or 1959, I go over to see my uncle at a hotel, and he introduces me to a man by the name of Hal Fine. Hal Fine owned a publishing company called Roosevelt Music.
And that's F-I-N-E? Hal Fine.
F-E-I-N.
What?
F-E-I-N.
Oh, okay. Yeah, F-E-I-N.
And the reason he introduced me is because my uncle, who's no longer around, we wrote a couple of songs together, one of which is responsible for the alias. We wrote a song called The Mark of Cain. And so at that time, but this was not at that moment, that came a little bit later. But he introduces me to Hal Fine, and he brags to him saying how wonderful and how great and blah, 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 blah. And most of it at the moment was not exactly true, relating to writing songs and how good he can do, etc., etc.
Oh, he's bragging about himself.
Well, he's bragging about me, actually.
Oh, okay.
And that's why he's introducing me. And Hal Fine says to go see his manager of the office in Manhattan, which was 1650 Broadway.
Right. What street is that?
That was actually 51st Street, precisely.
51st, okay.
Yep. And
is that where Tin Pan Alley is at that time?
Part of it, yes.
Okay.
That's part of it. And it goes down from there.
Right, on Broadway.
On Broadway, correct. It's actually, this building is exactly between 7th Avenue and Broadway, and then you just turn the corner, you're on Broadway, you go down, and that's the entire Tin Pan Alley and Show District.
And that goes like 20 streets, you mean, south?
It went, let's say, from 52nd, which is, let's say, where, you know, where the new. It's not new, but it's not old. It's where the Ed Sullivan Theater is. It's where
right.
CBS was. So 52nd, right down to, I'd say, 40th Street.
Okay.
Oh, what, 12 blocks or so, what have you.
Okay, so you're playing from you know, 54, 55, you know, 54 till 55 to 60. You're playing different scenes, but you're not playing in rock and roll.
That is pretty much, well, almost right. The time sequence is really interesting. I would actually need to think of the time sequence. But right in the same period of time, I got to meet a lady by the name of Jean Kaufman. And Jean Kaufman was Murray the K's mother.
Wow, okay.
Okay, and Jean Kaufman, actually, who really didn't have any talent at all, but she's still listed as a co-writer of Splish Splash with Bobby Darin.
Right, right, yeah.
And so she takes this huge liking to me, and we actually wrote a couple of little ditties together, which I put down on, you know, demo format. And unfortunately, I didn't know how to promote it at the time. And she, who basically, you know, I depended on her. But even at that time, she was, I guess she was somewhere about 60 years old then. So even though she had energy, I'm not sure just how far the connections went. And she had no help, even though at that time, Murray DeKay was giant. He was as big a DJ as he ever was at that point.
That's 1959-60.
That's 19, right.
Yeah.
And so, so nothing really became of that.
But let me say this. The pattern I'm seeing is that you get scouted by older people. So you're not a guy in high school hanging out with his buddies, which would get you into rock. You actually have talent that older people are noticing, and you're mixing with older people.
So that might be true, yeah. I guess that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
I never joined. I was in the orchestra, but I wasn't in the orchestra as, when I say orchestra, I'm talking about junior high school.
Yeah.
And high school, but I was as a saxophone player.
Oh, you could play several instruments then.
Well, I was able to play piano, accordion, saxophone, and drums.
Wow. Okay, so because you do the school thing, but you're also working with older people, including Gene Kaufman, and you're in the business, which your kids in school aren't in the business. You are.
Correct.
You're a bit of a prodigy, in a sense.
Well, I don't know if
Not extremely, but at least enough to hang out with the adults, and they want your talents.
Correct. Yeah, most people were always older than me.
Right.
That I was working with.
What was your brother doing in this period?
My brother was also working, because he's, as I don't know if I mentioned, 5.5 years older.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of well ahead of me. And he was working the better hotels.
He was doing the same thing you were.
That's right. I kind of followed in his footsteps.
And he didn't help you with Lee, but he would, once you were doing it in the late 50s, he would connect you with people. So you would...
That is actually very, very true. I'm glad you mentioned that, because the second hotel that I worked was a place that he worked first, and that's how I got that introduction the next year.
You're saying the next year is Lee, so you were in touch with that scene the year before through your brother, is what you're saying.
Well, the first time was with Lee. The second year is because my brother had worked this hotel, which was called the Overlook, and I worked that for 2 years in a row, so that would have been the second and third year of my career.
Oh, I see. You didn't do Lee again. And so
No, never. As a matter of fact, never did anything with him again after that summer.
Well, did your brother play in the same band in the second, third year?
No. He was into a better hotel.
Right, but he got you a connection with a band that gets you in another hotel.
Not a band, but the hotel owner.
Oh, okay.
And then I, myself, put the band together.
In the second year?
Right.
Wow. How did you find people to do that? By going to that building, that place?
Yeah, at that point, I had worked enough jobs and had, you know, kind of spread myself around a bit, so I knew people. And as it turns out, one of the musicians came from where I went to school.
Mm.
And so we knew each other, and so that was, you know, that was a real simple, easy connection. And it just came together like that.
Well, what jobs would you have in the winter?
In the winter?
In school.
You would call club dates. Club dates were anything from a wedding to a bar mitzvah to a sweet 16 party to a regular dance, just an ordinary dance, and stuff like that.
This would be in the Bronx. This would be.
Oh no! Most of it was Long Island, Brooklyn. Very few, as a matter of fact, in the Bronx.
Okay, so but not Manhattan, because that's
some, but not the majority. If I had to say, the majority would definitely be Long Island, Brooklyn.
Okay, so that's what you're doing in the late 50s. Rock and roll's taking over. What'd you think of Elvis?
I'm trying to wonder. I'm actually wondering what I thought. I don't know that I thought a whole lot. I've never thought a whole lot of bubblegum, I think, my whole life.
Teen music.
Yeah.
Teen rock and roll, you're not involved in, really.
It's non-believable, number one. There's no connection for me, number two, unless it's something that's extremely well written. And I can give you an example. If you gave me a song like I Love You, I Honestly Love You, the Olivia Newton-John song,
yeah,
would be a wonderful piece of bubblegum.
And you liked it when you heard it. You recognized something different.
Oh, yeah, you know, that. If you want to, again, another song, You Lost That Love and Feeling. Another
right.
Great song. But, you know, the song... all the stuff that you heard in the 50s, the middle 50s, and it was, shall I be blunt?
Yeah.
It basically is junk.
Right. Now, I see that as partly you're actually a musician and you're with older people. See, you're in the industry, you know, and it's just trivial stuff. I mean, you could play those songs with, you know, with your ears tied behind your back, kind of thing, right?
Right, and sometimes I did just because I couldn't stand them.
Okay, so how we were talking about R&B. Now, you didn't do doo-wop per se. You weren't singing on the corner, but how did you come in touch with that world? That's going to lead you to writing in Tin Pan Alley.
That is correct. I think just by being around it, listening to it, and when I went to meet the professional, what they call the professional manager, I'm not quite sure as if he, there were, you know, there were two tiers, the amateurish and professional, but after the summer that Hal Fine told me to go
to Gene,
Gene is a separate story. That was not his professional manager. That was just Murray DeKay's mother.
Okay, know? So Hal Fine tells you to go where?
To meet my professional manager when you get back to New York, and call, make an appointment and call. And he's actually kind of well known. He was his name was Wes Farrell, and
that's Wes F.
Wes, yeah, Farrell.
Farrell.
He was married to Tina Sinatra, Frank Sinatra's daughter.
Okay, now, at that time?
Not at that time.
Yeah, and she's older than Nancy Sinatra.
I don't know the specifics on that.
Right, Nancy did These Boots Are Made for Walking, 1966,
yes.
So Tina must have been older, because you're talking about an earlier phase.
Tina is younger.
Oh, okay, that's a later marriage, you mean?
I'm not sure of that.
Okay. So back to, why are you with Hal Fine? Who sent you to him?
My uncle, remember? Up in the Catskill Mountains, he introduces me, and the way he introduced me is because he was a guest at the same hotel that Hal Fine was. I went over to see my uncle to visit, and he said, you got to meet this guy. He owns a publishing company, and it's called Roosevelt Music. So we meet. He tries to impress him, and with all of that, Hal Fine says, yeah. So when you get back to New York, give Wes Farrell a call.
And that he's an employee of Hal Fine?
Correct.
Okay, in his office?
He ran the office.
So this is an interview situation when you go to see Wes Farrell, Matt.
That is basically right.
Right, so do you know the exact date of this?
No, I do not know the exact date, but it would have been 1960, I believe.
A couple of events that year. There was the U2 flights in May 1960. Kennedy's running for president that fall. Do you associate anything with that year that you're trying to recall?
Well,
any music of that year?
Yeah, Mac the Knife.
Okay, all right.
The biggest hit to come along in many a moon.
What does that mean? You mean it sold so much?
Yeah, Bobby Darin became gigantic off of that, and of course it was anything but a rock and roll tune.
That's right.
I mean, it was a big band song with loads of brass and reeds, and you know what Mac the Knife was, and anyway, it became probably one of the most airplayed songs of all time.
Interesting. So, who did Split Splash?
Bobby Darin.
Right. So did you get to meet him through Gene?
I got to meet, yes. But, yes, did. But
After this meeting of Wes Farrell?
No, that's now gone. After I meet Wes Farrell, there's no longer any connection with Gene or anything else.
So you already had met Bobby Darin?
Right.
Oh, okay. And you met him before Mac the Knife?
That is, well, at the same time.
Wow, so what? There's an interesting story. What was he like, as much as you were allowed to see, in this period of his glory?
Just, the ego is just gigantic. And he had made the statement, I can't really remember whether he made the statement at that moment in time, that I'm going to be bigger than Frank Sinatra. I'm assuming you heard that line at some point.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he made that statement that he was going to be bigger than Frank Sinatra. And, of course, we all know that didn't happen, unfortunately, you know, with a real premature death. And so what I did get, but this happened actually a little later. That didn't happen immediately. But anyway, we did not, you know, it's not like we hung out. It's not...
What is Jean doing? She writes Splish Splash, or connected to Splish Splash.
That's literally the only thing she ever really did, other than a couple of the things. And this is something that I just realized. Part of the reason for her connecting, not for the reason for connecting, but the reason that she spent the time that she spent with me is she actually kind of had a bitter taste because Bobby Darin, basically, after Splish Splash became a hit, kind of blew her off.
Yeah, because he was selfish, yeah. Narcissistic. He just was into his own self. He didn't care who got him there.
And the truth of the matter is, I mean, as I said, she really didn't have any talent.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, anyway.
But she met him because of Murray the K?
That is correct.
I see. So she would be able to meet all the youth culture through Murray and then figure out what she wanted to do with it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Was she a big influence on Murray?
That I do not really know. I know that he was not too thrilled about, you know, being with her. Aside from that, I really don't know what the family history was.
But she was like a meddling showbiz mother.
That's a very, very good description.
Right, and we have to, just for the audience, Murray the K is the guy who introduces the Beatles to America, right?
That would be a good question to Google, you know. I don't even know whether it was Murray the K. He had WINS. But I'm not sure that they were on his show first, because when they hit so, you know, dramatically that it could have been
Cousin Brucey.
WABC.
Right.
And so, and then there's a couple of others that were also Alan Freed.
Yeah.
Seen at that point, you know. So I'm not sure. That's a good question. Who actually played?
Who played them before they were on Ed Sullivan? The weeks leading up to it.
Ed Sullivan is 1964.
No, it's February. Yes, you're right. It's right after the Kennedy assassination. February 64. You're right.
Yeah. So that's quite a ways later. That's, you know, later after they've already been just jumping up the airwaves all over the place.
Right. Okay, so back to Murray the K is an up-and-coming DJ. He may not be he's certainly not as big as Alan Freed.
He was as big. Yeah, he and Bruce, Cousin Brucey, were the two biggest in New York.
And was Alan Freed considered New York?
No. Alan Freed, I guess you could consider, because that was local. New York, you know, those stations were local.
Yeah.
Alan Freed, you could actually, I would look at him as kind of like national, because he was running all the big rock and roll shows, they ran in all the big cities.
That's right. Did he have a TV show like Dick Clark?
I don't believe, you know what? Something says yes, and it was for like a short period of time, but I'm not sure if I'm not making it.
Yeah, and then the payola hit him, and then he was diminished at the
That's pay- right. He
yeah.
was taking, yeah, so you know what, he definitely had, he was definitely on radio, and that's where I think the payola came.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about TV, though.
Right, in my mind, I was surprised once I saw footage of him being on TV, but I don't know what that was. But yeah, definitely Dick Clark was happening, and Alan Freed, he'd be big before Morrow and Murray the K, but then the payola would hit him, and then they'd fill the gap, and then he'd be weakened by 1960, and just doing the shows, actual live shows.
That's right, and the only one that stepped in that was Dick Clark, as you said, with the TV show. But Dick Clark wasn't really, as far as I know, he might have been behind the scenes for all I know, as far as the large shows, you know, like the Paramount shows when they were,
right.
And they'd put together a bunch of acts and bing, they'd go out.
And Alan Freed would be the visible MC in those shows?
Alan Freed, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm interested in how, it's interesting to have Is Bobby Darin the same age as you?
No. Bobby Darin's about five, was about 6 years older, I guess.
Okay, so you're with, see, what's interesting is that you get to see what's going on behind the scenes. You're a kid hoping to do something in music, and you've been interviewed by Wes Farrell. What comes of that interview?
What happened? You know, that's something I've been thinking about as you've been talking. What I did was I sat down and I played for him a couple of little ditties, nothing much to speak of, but he was real impressed with my playing, and he was he said, well, let's try and write a few tunes. And I said, okay, and we did.
Right there in that first interview?
No, I don't believe it was that first interview. That I do not have a perfect recollection of, but I do remember the first tune that we wrote, and wrote a couple, and one of them actually became number one in Australia. And just maybe about 2 months ago, I literally got to hear the final record that I never actually got to listen to because it never happened big in the United States. It was on the Hot 100, but the Hot 100 doesn't really mean anything. If you're not in the top 40,
yeah,
virtually not going to hear it unless you're lucky and you happen to be in a particular city that the song is hot. Otherwise, you're just not going to hear it.
Okay. So how did you hear it?
So what I did was I went on the computer, and the name of the... it was recorded by a couple of people, but the only one that went number one in Australia was Johnny O'Keefe. And
what was the name of the song?
The name, that's funny. What's funny is we wrote it under the name Move and Groove, but when Johnny Spence recorded it, it was recorded, the title was Move, Baby, Move. So I Googled it, and I actually brought it up, and I literally heard the whole version of it just about 2 months ago for the first time. And the reason I finally did that is because I've been getting royalties all these years.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't have a copy. I never even, you know, I don't remember what the thing was. And there's a kind of a side story with that. And let me just briefly, when it was titled Moving Groove, Wes Farrell and myself, we literally produced that record. And it was on VJ Records.
I remember them.
And the artist was Gil Hamilton.
Yeah.
Okay? And that was a sensational record. I mean, sensational. And the sad part about that is it burned in my house, burned up back in 1978, and an attaché case which had lots of my stuff in it burned with it.
Mm.
And so the point is this. What we didn't know at the time, this guy, Gil Hamilton, he signed a contract with us, but we didn't know that he had recorded for a company called Diamond Records, and he had this huge hit. And the huge hit was, here we go, loop-de-loo. Here we go, loop-de-lie. Do you remember that song?
Yes.
All on a Saturday Night.
Yeah.
That was a huge hit, and he couldn't care less about us. Our song, and by the way, his name on that loop-de-loo was called Johnny Thunder. He gave us his real name of Gil Hamilton. So that comes out on VJ, while this other song of his, at the same time virtually, within the same couple weeks, is happening real big, and that's on Johnny Thunder. And so VJ puts it out, and we got like into the 60s with it, and then that was the end of that, and he was kind of like basically a one-hit wonder anyway, so that's basically that story.
Okay, let me get this clear. Johnny Spence, is he an American?
No, he's Australian.
So he hears Guy Hamilton's song.
Gil Hamilton.
Gil Hamilton. He hears that and does his own local version.
Exactly.
And you can get royalties no matter what country it's in, you know, it's there.
Well, unless it's China.
Okay. Right.
So, go ahead.
Okay, so Gil, for another company, not telling anybody, not telling you guys, he does another song for Diamond Records, and that becomes a big hit.
Right, he actually did that first, and that was already in the works, and it was happening. We didn't know it at the time.
So he becomes known on a bigger level as Johnny Thunder.
Correct.
And he might, those that heard the Gil Hamilton song would know it's Johnny Thunder.
If you listen to the two put together, you might find, you know, you might hear the similarities in voice.
Right.
Okay, well, what I did, Matt, was I
didn't hear what you said.
Oh, yeah, you zipped over. Okay, so you went in the distance for some reason. Okay, back to, the point is that you meet, this is what's interesting, you meet with Wes, and you're just, you're 19 years old, 18 years old. Are you in college? Yeah, you're in college.
In college, I'm just about to get out at that point to graduate.
You mean high school?
No, I mean college.
Well, you're 41, 19 in 1960. We're talking 1960 when you meet with Wes.
Well, I'm in college, right?
Okay, so you got another year or so, maybe of
right.
College. Okay, so you meet with this guy. He says, come back next week, and we'll see if we can write a song.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Now, what I'm interested in, how does that work? You go into this building. This is not Don Kirshner's scene, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, Don Kirshner was a couple of floors up. If I remember correctly, I think the number, and I've never thought about this, I think he was 606, and Hal Fine at Roosevelt Music was on the fourth floor. Same building.
Where is the Carole King gang?
In Don Kirshner's office.
Oh, they're up there. So Kirshner's the top guy right then.
At that point in time, he's happening pretty damn big, yeah.
Okay. And Hal Fine isn't that successful.
Yeah, he actually is, because he had a man by the name of Bert Kempfert. Ever hear of Bert Kempfert?
Yeah, I recognize K-E-M-P-F-A-R-T or E-R-T, yeah.
Bert Kempfert, for instance, wrote the music The Strangers in the Night.
Yeah.
He also wrote something with a Starry Night. Ba, 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 ba.
Right.
Just an instrumental. And he had done something revolutionary, and perhaps you'll find this interesting, Scott. And that is, in Germany, they only used one microphone for many, many instruments, including strings, brass, reeds, and it was right in the center. And
that worked? That was good enough?
Yeah, he made super, super duper records. He knew exactly how to place people, which section should be where, etc. Anyway.
Wait, you're talking about Bert Kempfert?
Correct.
In Germany, he would do this?
Yes, and then he would send the stuff over. Then it all came over to the United States.
So he had a certain magic. He was original to do one microphone or something.
Yeah, he actually invented that process.
Okay, so what would be the number of microphones normally in New York?
Well, in New York at the time, everybody, every section would have a microphone.
Right.
Drums would have two and three microphones.
Right, and he did one. That's crazy.
One for the whole thing. And he just knew how to, he was just, he was more than just, he understood sound and he understood electronics and whatever it was, you know, that he did. But so he was very, very big already in Germany, and he was partners to some extent. I don't know the exact dealings with Hal Fine.
Okay, so Hal had hits through that guy.
Through that guy, and then there were just other songs that were happening, and it wasn't anywhere near as successful as Don Kirshner. But it was, it was happening. He was doing fine.
Okay, so I'm interested. You walk in. What time do you show up in the morning? You're going to start writing a song. How does that work?
Well, that's one good thing about having been in my business. There was never pretty much a time, unless, of course, we said, let's get together at 10 o'clock. But usually it was a very casual kind of thing.
So you would show up and hang around till he was ready?
Well, I wouldn't hang around. Usually when I came in, I'd go into a room, and there was always pianos in all the different rooms.
So you could start by yourself?
Yeah, could do that.
And he's busy, so you're going to do more of the basic work at first until he comes over into your room, and then you start talking.
Right. And
how long did it take to make that move and groove or whatever it was called?
The writing of it or the producing of the record?
The writing, these first couple of talking.
Most of the songs that I have written in my lifetime have come real quickly. Probably not more than that day. I can't tell you in terms of minutes, hours. I can tell you one particular song of which was number one in Japan four times since 1970, and I remember that taking 15 minutes.
To compose it?
To compose it, yeah.
To write it out on a music sheet?
Oh, to write it out on a music sheet? Who knows, maybe an hour.
Right, okay, so you compose it acoustically, and then you write in 15 minutes, then you write it out.
Correct.
I see. And so in the popular term today is channeling. It kind of just comes through you.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
I mean, that first day, it's going to be your first. Had you written songs before your interaction with Wes?
Yes.
And that's just sitting around on your own pace and just hearing things. It comes to you, you try it out, then you think of something else, and then something else comes to you. It's just a playful thing, right?
It's a kind of a trial and error.
Right. So, and that may go on a whole day, you know, depending.
Yeah, right. It could go on a whole day. It could go on for longer than that.
Okay, so you've done that. So you start tinkling about, and you and Wes, you get your first song. What was it called? Move and Groove?
No, that wasn't the first song. The first song was a thing called Muck Luck Glide that you wrote specifically for Chubby Checker.
Wow.
And after we finished the song, he had an XKE Jaguar.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that he picks me up in the Bronx, and we drive to Philadelphia, because that was the home of Bernie Lowe. And Bernie Lowe included Bobby Rydell, Fabian, Chubby Checker, Frankie Avalon.
That's the Philadelphia period.
That was the Philadelphia period. And boy, was I impressed when we drive into Philadelphia, which is a 90 to 100-mile drive, and we're driving just to play that song. That's it. There is nothing else we've got to do there.
Well, wait a minute. This is Chubby Checker driving you?
No, this is Wes Farrell.
Oh, okay. So you compose this song. Is Chubby Checker, is he...
No, he's not listening. Bernie Lowe is listening for him.
I know, but, you say you wrote it for Chubby. How does that work in the bureaucracy? Hal Fine gets a call from Bernie who says, "All right, get someone to write a song for Chubby." Is that how it goes?
No, that was not how it went. We, Wes and I, simply said, let's see if we can write another theme kind of song.
With the twist angle.
Of course, now he's done the twist. It's a giant, giant hit.
Yeah.
And I can't remember whether he had done something else already. I remember he did the Limbo, but I think that might have been afterwards.
Right, yeah, it was, I think.
Limbo Rock.
Yeah.
So right after the tour, right as the twist is happening, we come up with this idea, Muck Luck Glide, and the whole idea is to be playing around in the snow.
It's Muck Luck, L-I-E?
Muck Luck is L-U-C. Muck Luck Glide.
Oh, glide, G-L-I-D-E.
Right.
Oh, okay, Muck Luck Glide. So you're talking about playing in the snow.
Right. And it's supposed to be like a dance in the snow.
You're trying to invent a new dance.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, but who requested it? You guys just said, we'll do it, and then call up Chubby's manager and say, look, we got this for you.
Right, that's exactly how it happened.
And Wes can do this without Hal telling you or anything.
I can't be positive whether Wes made the call or whether there was somebody above Wes at the time and he was Hal Fine's brother-in-law, and his name was Jerry Brown. Wow. It's hard for me to believe I remember that. Anyway, Jerry Brown, and so, as I say, I'm not sure whether it was Wes or whether it was Jerry Brown or possibly even Hal Fine himself. But we say we've got the song.
And so, but see, you create the song, then you tell Hal and he calls them.
Right, if that was who it was.
You're right, whoever it was. But you guys just do it, free enterprise, say, we're going to make something and see if it sticks.
That's perfect, yeah.
Yeah, and so how does Burt Lowe hears it somehow, right?
We go there and we play it.
Oh, that's what you're doing. You're driving down to audition it.
Yeah, we drive to Philadelphia.
To Philadelphia's Tin Pan Alley, so to speak.
Yeah.
And he's got Fabian, Bobby Rydell.
Frankie Avalon.
Wow.
And Chubby Checker. And what impressed me the most is when we get there, he has his name across this huge building, the Bernie Lowe Building. I'd never seen that before.
L-O-W-E?
Oh, L-O-W-E, yes.
Yeah. So you've never met the guy. He's just a legend, an instant legend. So you're going to go meet this big deal because the action has moved to Philadelphia, you know, in the teen market, right?
Well, it never moved to Philadelphia, but it was certainly another big market.
Right. So, Mac the Knife is coming out of New York?
Yes.
Okay. So you go and play on a piano to Bert? Was it Bertie? Bert?
Bernie.
You play it on the piano to him?
Correct.
And what's he goes, wow, or does he go, I don't know. How does that go?
Yeah, he was actually noncommittal, and nothing ever really happened as a result of that.
Okay, so we're telling this story because this is the first song you attempted.
That's right, with Wes.
Yeah, and did you meet Fabian and Bobby Rydell while there?
No.
Okay. Do you meet any of them ever later?
Let's see. No, but the only thing that I did remember is that my brother and I, when we're working together, and this goes to the year, and let me just think about this for a second. This goes to the year about 1967, 68. So that would be not a long time later, you know, like 6 years, 7 years later. And we are working at the Playboy Club in Arizona. And there's an advertisement for Chubby Checker working in a real downscale club.
Yeah.
And I remember how depressed I kind of was for this guy who was, I mean, he was...
The king. Know, he was the king.
That's right. He was the king of the day. I mean, between him and Elvis Presley, that was it. And now he's working a place where, I don't know, he was maybe making $150 a week.
So that was your first encounter of the real fact of the music industry?
That was
one of the major shocks.
Well, it was a shock, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but we should explain that that's when you teamed up with your older brother and were the Brothers Kane.
That actually didn't happen until about 2 years from then.
69. Oh, okay.
No.
I know you saw you were at the Trip in 65 and saw Smokey Robinson, and Dylan was in the audience.
My brother and I, we were the first job that we actually worked together professionally was in 63.
As the Kane Brothers Kane?
Brothers Kane. And not a little bit after we started, we changed the name. And that's a story in itself.
Okay, we'll go there. So back to you and Wes fail on that song, and then what's the next song? Like, well, how do you get to the hit?
Well, that could have been Move and Groove. That might have been the next thing. We did several songs, and I'm trying to remember.
Move and Groove was Gil Hamilton.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. That was Gil Hamilton.
Okay. So now, just in the workaday thing. You now are you go there every day? Okay, he wanted to see West Fair wants to hear you write a song. So you write that song. Do you come back the next day to make another one, or are you just not doing anything for a few weeks?
There was never a time when a few weeks went by. There were times when days went by, but not a few weeks.
So it's actually quite slack, relaxing, you know. You work a couple days, then do something else, then go back and try another song. You know, it's not a 9-to-5 grind.
Not at all.
It's pretty cool. I mean, a way to make money, right?
Well, it's what you want to be doing, and it's when you want to be doing it. So even though it might have been longer than 9-to-5, it's not because I was punching a clock. It's because I was having
a good time making the song.
Exactly.
Okay, so now another thing about you not meeting Bobby Rydell is that you still have, quote, a superiority complex to this teen music. It's not really your world of music. You know, it's a joke almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's just a way it's definitely a form of expression, but it certainly was not my highest or best to come.
Right. So you're doing composing songs, but are you working gigs and playing
Yes.
in bands?
Yes, I am. I'm doing all of that. I'm doing, as I said, what they call club dates. And funny, in the East, it's called club dates, meaning weddings and bar mitzvahs, etc. On the West Coast, it's called casuals.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So I'm doing that all the time.
And doing non-rock and roll music largely in the club dates.
Yeah, right. Now, occasionally,
yeah. We'd
play the twist, you know, and a party would get going of whatever kind, so we'd do that. But not lots of rock and roll, no, not at all.
Maybe one or two Elvis?
Maybe, yeah.
But basically, the music before rock and roll.
Standards.
Yeah, the standards. Okay, because you're doing it for adults, older people, older than you, and
that
people.
Is correct.
Yeah. Okay, so you're doing that. Is that? Do you ever get into a jazz band?
Yes, but not as a steady working thing because at that time, it was not, and even today, it's not as lucrative.
Yeah.
As other. You know.
That's
as
right.
Other.
Yeah. Okay, so are you now working for Hal Fine and with Wes for the next few years?
There was probably about 2 years. I was doing it simultaneous while working with also, because at the same time, I actually started before, no, I guess Hal Fine was first, and then I started working at Don Kirshner's because I had met somebody who worked there, and he
thought you had talent, so he brought you in?
Yes, exactly. His name was Jack Keller, who wrote quite a few hits, one for Connie Francis, Everybody's Somebody's Fool.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote Run to Him for Bobby V.
Yeah.
And
good songs. They're all good songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we wrote a song together. We wrote one song together. But before that, he brought me in, and I kind of auditioned for Donnie and for the office manager, whose name was Emil Laviola.
Emil, A-M-I-L.
E-M-I-L.
Oh, Emil, okay. So what... How do you audition for Don Kirshner? Do you play something, or do you write present what you wrote before?
Like both. I play and write something that I've already got done.
Yeah. So you tell him, here's my latest song, or you
right.
play it. And so how'd that go?
That went fine, and he said, "Here, take a room." And he introduced me to the guy who I wrote my first song with it at Donnie Kirshner's.
What was that?
And I have to, let's see, his first name is Artie, and I just got to, you know, I actually would have to go downstairs, and Artie Kaplan, his
okay.
name.
Okay, and what song did you do with him?
We wrote a song that didn't do anything called Don't Call Me, I'll Call You.
Right, but here's the thing, Don gives you a room. and you don't come in every day?
Almost every day.
All right, and what, do you have to be there at the 9 or 10?
Oh, no time.
You just have to show up every day.
You don't have to, you do.
You don't have to, but you want to. You want to make something.
That's exactly right.
It's almost like, wow, we could make some huge money today. Every day you got a chance to play the lottery, and it's fun.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lottery, but it's not just passively signing a ticket. You are actually going to have fun and might get a lot of money for having fun. That's appealing.
That's definitely, yeah. And at the time, as I really remember pretty good, it really was never about the money. It really wasn't. It was about just creating something and getting something accepted. And
having something that you have the thrill of everybody dancing to it. And having it on the radio.
Or just simply liking it. Yeah, the radio was a very, very important aspect of it. And there's one great story. I know it's kind of jumping ahead.
That's all right.
I was at a party one time where there was this record player, and everybody was hogging the record player because they all wanted to play their latest stuff. And if you ever saw a bunch of people that was ready to cut each other's throats. I mean, it was truly, truly an amazing kind of thing.
This is just a party with a hi-fi or something.
Yeah, you're supposed to have a good time. Meanwhile, they're like ripping the arm of the photograph out of each other's hands.
So that you looked at that and said, wow, what's going on here? It was so...
Yeah, and at that party, I'll never forget, you know who it was at that particular party? One of the people was Jimmy Clanton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I guess whatever we say can be cut out, right?
Yes.
Well, you know the song that he had, Venus in Blue Jeans?
Yes.
Right? Well, we used to sing, My Penis is My Blue Jeans.
No, we don't have to cut that out. That's
okay.
That's good. Okay, so the thing is that you would go in there every day, and that's when you would meet Carole King, who were hanging around themselves.
She was actually not. She was the most active of all. She'd already hit with, and this is actually even, I think, on her tour that she does with James Taylor. Have you been watching that PBS thing?
No, I didn't see it, but I know about it.
Yeah, she and Jerry, her ex-husband,
yeah,
you know, they used to have actual jobs. And she, as soon as they hit with "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow," all hell broke loose for them. And so all they, you know, they were out of the office most of the time, simply writing at home, because in the office was basically, I guess, to some degree, a distraction.
Right. So that was the goal. You get a certain level of status. You don't. It's work at home.
Right. You could. It's not even a matter of the status. It's a preference. That, number one, you can certainly turn out probably more in your home than, you know, having to interact with other people and what have you. But
who was she married to?
Jerry Goffin.
Goffin?
Yep.
Oh, is that G-U-F-F-E-N?
I-N.
I-N. So where's Lieber Stoller in this mix?
Okay. I had, as soon as I had connected with...
Kirshner
and Hal Fine, I was under contract to nobody.
There's no paper sign. They just allow you in the place to improvise, to talk to people.
And in most cases, there were contracts signed. And the reason people signed contracts was so that they could get a little bit of an advance. And I mean a little bit, but a little bit then was better than nothing.
Right. So you would sign some papers.
But I didn't sign. I was one of the few who didn't, so I could go from one place to another. And, of course, all hell broke loose one time.
But wait, why would you want to go from one place to another?
Well, just more opportunity.
Right. I mean, you got nothing written, so you can hang out with anybody.
Right.
And you're starting to be known as part of that select group of mingling songwriters. You're allowed, you can go hang out with anybody, right?
Yeah, and it actually, in one sense... To be truthful, it did hurt me at one point, because one night I was in Donnie Kirshner's secretary's home, and he called her, and he was screaming so loud that I could hear through the phone, and him, he was asking, where is my contract? And she said, Donnie, I'll never forget this. He
no, no, where is my, meaning yours?
Yes, meaning...
He goes, where is Matt, what were you known as, Matt Maurer?
Yes.
Where is Matt Maurer's contract on some song?
No, just in general.
Because he'd heard that you were mingling, so he says...
No, he heard, what happened was, I wrote a song with Wes...
Farrell.
And Dion.
No, did you say Wes Farrell?
Yeah, Wes Farrell and Dion.
Yeah.
And Dion recorded it, and when it came out, it went right to the top.
Okay.
Now he hears the song, and he goes crazy, and when he finds out, I'm part of that. So he calls up and he's screaming at her, where is his contract to write for him exclusively? There is no contract.
Right, and she says there isn't, and he says, well, get one.
Well, it's too late at that point. He never did ask. He was so angry about that, he didn't want, he basically didn't want to even see me.
Okay, so you've got a hit, and it's aligned with Hal Fine, if anybody?
Yes, Hal Fine.
But you didn't sign anything, but you're, don't you get, you have to sign public, write, songwriter?
You sign a writer's contract, but not an exclusive for every song.
That's what you're talking about. You never sign an exclusive contract.
No, and if you'd like to see the contract, I've actually still got that particular contract.
For the Dion song.
That's right.
Well, what's the song?
And the song, it's, do you remember there were two songs? It was called, one was Ruby Baby.
Yeah.
And the other is He'll Only Hurt You.
What's the second one?
He'll Only Hurt You.
That's vague.
Okay,
sure.
Well, anyway, those two were on the same record.
Okay.
And
so,
they both go number one.
Wow. They're both played.
Right. And as a matter of fact, today, as we speak, for the last couple of years, we're in this constant back and, well, not constant, neither of us has actually had any communication in a long time, over the percentage of publishing rights. It's a real jumble. But anyway, that's
so who's you and who else?
Me, Wes Farrell, Dion, and then there were suddenly two names, and I know who they are, but they never had anything to do with the song, and of course, at the time, there was nothing I could do about it, because I'm low man on the totem pole.
Right.
Why those two names were on the song, I don't know. I do know that Dion had a connection with them, so maybe he was, I don't know.
He included them in, gave
them
a favor.
Either he included them in so that a larger share of the money would come over to his side, of which maybe he worked out some side deal. I have no idea.
But is Dion still alive?
Yes, I believe he is. He had huge problems, you know, with addiction.
Okay.
But I heard an interview, but it's easily a couple years, where he, you know, gave his wife all the credit in the world for sticking with him all the years.
Right.
And helping him out of it.
And Wes Farrell still alive?
To my knowledge.
But you're saying you're communicating with them, sort of, over this...
That was Dion.
Oh, so...
And there's also one other, and that is Screen Gems Columbia.
For what? For that song?
For the percentage of publishing rights, because after a song left the 28-year mark, everybody can claim it.
Wait, you mean anybody can reissue it and say it's theirs? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Wow.
All you have to do is put in for it. That has now changed. It changed after 1978. Today, a copyright is good for 75 years, but at the time, it was 28 years, and then you had to renew it. It wasn't automatically yours. You had to renew it.
Right.
What you renew it for was another 28. So 56. But after 1978, when you write a song now, it's for 75 years.
Okay, so back to... So Don is yelling about you. Now, do you still go over to his office?
I did. I don't know for how long, but at that...
But you were frozen out.
Well, not exactly... But things were never quite the same.
Yeah, you wouldn't be, you'd have to struggle to get one of your songs in, because he'd favor other people, probably.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true. And so I was now also connected with Lieber and Stola.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
That simply happened. I knew a couple of the people that worked there, and I went over there, and I met a guy that I wrote one of the Jane the American hits for. And we collaborated on a song, and boom, it was Burt Bacharach who was producing Jane the Americans for Lieber and Stola.
Right.
And Burt Bacharach had written three songs. It was for what they call at the time a single session as opposed to an album.
Right.
And we wrote this one song, and Burt Bacharach, who was at that time, we're talking 1963 now.
Yeah.
He selected our song as the A-side. I mean, I was blown away. I don't know of another time where a session, especially that Burt Bacharach produced and wrote for, didn't put one of his songs out, and deservedly so, obviously, not just a song, but the best song. But he chose our song, and of course that's called Come Dance With Me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And so...
That was a hit?
Yeah.
So, okay, so that was a lucky break. Now that when do you think Don yelled about you? 62 or 61?
Yeah, 62.
62. So you got 2 years there with Hal, then Don. Now you get into 63, you're hanging out more with Lieber Stoller.
I'm kind of bouncing around, yeah.
Right.
And at the same time, because now is the year that my brother and I finally, what happens is, all this time while I'm writing for these different companies, my brother was working at a place called, and it was world famous, the Concord Hotel.
Yeah.
And in the Catskill Mountains. And on weekends, I would go up. And he was playing just a single. He was playing piano in the bar. And, of course, when you think of bar, you think of small. This is probably the biggest bar you would ever see in your lifetime.
Okay.
And it had the most action you would ever see in your lifetime. And I would go up there on weekends, and there was a set of drums on the stage because opposite my brother was a trio. And so they would alternate half an hour.
Right.
I would go up on weekends, and I would play. That's how I learned to play drums.
That's you start late in that period.
I actually learned on the job, you might say.
Yeah.
And when I say learned to play drums, I never became a really good drummer, but good enough to just simply see and hold the beat.
Do the standards.
Yeah, nothing fancy.
Right. Now, is the Concord Hotel... Oh, carry on. What were we going to say?
So, one weekend, we had also learned... We'd learned three songs together. One of which was the hit of the day, again, not a rock and roll song, Something Big. You remember that?
Oh, that might be...
Steve Allen wrote that.
No, I'm thinking of, there's a Ray Charles kind of song, but there was...
Anyway, that song was went something like, you're walking along the street, you're at a party, you da-da-da-da-da-da, you suddenly dig, you're looking in someone's eyes, you suddenly realize that this could be the start of something big. Edie Gourmet and Steve Lawrence had a number one hit.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Right in the middle of doo-wop, doo-wop.
That's right, Steve and Edie,
right.
Is what they were called?
Oh.
Yeah. I don't recall that song.
Yeah, Giant.
Okay, I missed that one.
Giant. Anyway, so...
But I remember Edie, was it Stevie and Edie, or what were they called?
Yeah, Steve and Edie.
Yeah, I remember them being an anomaly. I mean, they were the old kind of singers, and all of a sudden they're right there with a hit.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Not only that hit, they also had, you know, Go Away, Little Girl.
That was a good one.
That was his. Alone, and Edie Gourmet had Blame It on the Bossa Nova.
Right.
That was her thing. So
why are we talking about them? What brought that up?
Only because of the song was written by Steve Allen that my brother and I sang that night. We'd known three songs. That was the first one, and we would do the three tunes while we were playing up at the Concord for that when I was up there during the weekend. And one weekend, a man by the name of Danny Siegel saw us right on the spot after we came off. And, of course, we thought it was, you know, just a big come on.
Yeah.
Said, I want you to open at my club Monday.
Wow.
Now, this was Friday night. This is, and now I just got a little goosebump again. It's funny. This was Friday night. He's saying, I'm Danny Siegel. And by the way, Danny Siegel owned a place called The Living Room.
Yeah.
That was the best place in New York if you were not playing at the Copa.
Wow.
Okay.
And you knew that.
Yeah, of course. And so now I don't know if it's real or not. Are we really, and my brother is wondering, what do I do?
Because you were just singing covers. You were just singing other people's songs, right?
Yeah, and we didn't know any more than three tunes.
Yeah, they weren't yours or just whatever.
Right.
But you did them really well from Siegel's point of view.
Right. And so my brother quits the job. He leaves there on Sunday bright and early in the morning. He does the next night. He actually gives one day notice to the Concord. They're not happy. We do not have a signed contract at all, but a promise to show up Monday and go on and perform.
It's almost like getting on Ed Sullivan.
So, we go home.
No, you know what I mean? It's so big, it's like getting on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, I know, I know. And we go home to the Bronx, and I set an impossible task. We learn West Side Story, including Something's Coming and Officer Krupke. The reason I chose those two tunes, I did not want to just do fluff.
Right.
And I wanted some comedy.
Right. And how many songs are you going to have to do?
We did five, because he said do about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Well, the three tunes would have taken like about 10 and a half, 11, 12 minutes.
Right.
We did this Officer Krupke, which is a long piece of material, if you remember it.
No, I don't. They don't know that.
You know, but you know the song itself, right?
Or, no, I never
saw it. I'm Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our father all are punks. Jesus, Krupke, that's why we up. You don't...
No, West Side Story, I don't think I ever saw. I don't know it.
Best show ever, 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 ever.
That's what people tell me. Yeah, I better go see it sometime.
Yeah, and the man who wrote it.
No, you, okay.
Since we're talking,
you've seen West Side Story. You go and see it, and you love the thing.
No, we didn't go see it. I already knew the tune. I just had to sit down with the music. And
how'd you know it? By it's on record?
I had the music.
Okay, but you never, you say it's the best musical ever.
Right.
What's that based on? You hadn't seen it then?
I was listening to it on record.
You never went to it?
No. Oh, but I got the music for it.
Right. It's the best music and probably a good show if you actually took the time to see it.
Written by one of the two best writers of all time. Of all time. And he's still alive today, and that's Sondheim. Even Sondheim.
Right, right.
Okay. So...
Okay, so what are the three songs you're already doing at the Concord?
Okay, at the Concord we're doing, this could be the start of something big.
Yeah.
We're doing I'd Love to Get You on a Slow Boat to China, All to Myself Alone. You know that?
Yeah.
And then we're doing a song which is a calypso beat, and it's a calypso song.
Yeah, it's the Harry Belafonte period.
Yeah, but it's not one of those. It's not one of the popular ones like that.
So you're doing those three, you're going to add two from West Side Story.
Right, and we did those two kind of as a medley.
Right.
Okay. And just to bring it down, we open at the Living Room, and we were opening. There was already a full-scale show. He always would have three acts. We were building the paper with our own billing on that Monday night. He got it to the paper, extra added attraction.
The Brothers Kane?
Not yet. It was while we were working there that we changed our name. But we used our real name for that.
What's that?
Which, our real name? You already have the real
name. The Brothers Moore?
Well, no, the Moore Brothers.
Okay, the Moore Brothers.
Yeah.
All right.
And, we open, and we get this sensational review from a man by the name of Jack Thompson, the Daily New York Mirror.
Right. I don't know that name.
Right. He says, Danny Siegel says to me, he says to us, he said, you're booked indefinitely.
Wow.
The next thing he says to us, I want to be your manager. And we became this overnight success at this place.
Okay, but now that's going to lead, hopefully, to a record contract, right?
Well, are we going to open the whole can of worms all at once?
No, yeah, I'm not saying, but that's what the goal is, isn't it?
Well, that was a goal, yeah, definitely.
Or was it just good enough to being at the top club in New York, and that's cool enough?
No, it's after that point, nothing was ever good enough.
So this is, I mean, you guys are really good singers at this point. What is it that's wowing everybody?
I don't know. Maybe our good looks.
Well, how tall were you and your brother?
About 4.5 feet. No.
No. What? You're
how tall?
5'11".
My brother is 5'11", yeah, and I guess I'm just a hair under 5'10".
Okay. All right, so...
Of course, I'm balding.
Right. And what are you wearing? What kind of costumes in that first night?
Wow, that's a great question.
I mean, you got to have something, right?
I know I had underwear on.
Oh, that's why everybody was cheering.
You know what? We might have been in probably the worst outfits of all. And that probably was tuxedos.
Yeah.
I'm thinking tuxedos.
Because that's all you had.
Yeah.
Well, did you change your costume
for the
ongoing thing?
Yeah, we radically changed it.
Okay, so you would be the first opener. You'd be the opener for the whole evening, right?
Right. And boy, I tell you, we really set the tone, and nobody really wanted to go on after us. We did create a lot of excitement.
Wow. Okay. What names are come on after you?
There was one big name that you would hear of, and one of the people we worked with was Jack Jones.
Yes.
And
I know Jack Jones, yeah.
And another was David Fry, you know, the impressionist.
The comedian, yeah, he did Nixon or something, didn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
David Fry, who else? Oh, Felicia Sanders. Does that name ring a bell?
Felicia who?
Sanders.
Not really.
Okay,
no.
Well, she was giant in the club circuit.
Right.
She wasn't national, but she wasn't big, big television, but she did... some television, and she was excellent, really, really good.
Okay, now what's happening right at that time in the pop culture is folk music. You guys are not folk music.
No, but we wrote this song called The Mark of Cain.
Yeah.
And Uncle, who I told you about before, introduced me to Hal Fine. He was part of the writer. It was actually his original idea. And we write the song. And the writer, when we sing it the first night at the living room, the writer, Jack Thompson, says, nobody is going to do this song any better than us.
Wow.
And, yeah, we got all these wonderful accolades, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a folk song.
Right. And so we get so much play on this song in the press, like they kept making jokes about it, go see the Brothers Cain if you're able.
Oh, that's how that came. That's how it came about.
That's exactly how it came.
Right.
They actually said it. Go see the Brothers Cain if you're able. My mother wasn't very, very happy with that, I'll have to admit.
Right, but the thing is, how did they know you were Cain since you were more brothers?
Because the song was called The Mark of Cain.
Oh, yeah. So they called it the Brothers
Cain. Brothers Abel and Cain.
Yeah, I get you.
See the Brothers Cain.
Yeah.
And so...
Because you were so good at it, no one else could record it.
Well, yeah.
That's not good.
Well, it was what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Okay, so how long do you do that?
We did the living room, and then we signed a contract with Danny Siegel to be our manager. And the first thing he gets us, he introduces us right away... and it was through a deal kind of thing, but that's unimportant, to the Playboy clubs.
Right.
And he books us because his good friend is the booker of all Playboy clubs, and his name was Shelley Caston.
Shelley what?
Shelley Caston.
Caston, okay.
Who was a real good friend of Hefner.
Is that male or female, Shelley?
Shelley was male.
Okay.
And Shelley Keston was really a good friend because he was one of the people that financed Hefner before he ever became Playboy.
Is that right?
Yeah. There were three people, and Shelley Keston was one, and as a reward for that, he got to book all the entertainment all over the world.
For Playboy's clubs?
Right.
Now, what do you think of, is there any evidence of mafia money helping Hefner at the beginning?
I do not know that.
Okay. So the thing is that you, see, you're always in a little beyond your age level. You see, this is adult stuff. I mean, guys your age are in college or just getting out of college.
Well, I was 22 at the time.
Yeah, you're young for that adult world. It's adult world to play with. See, the older people.
Well, I was in a rush.
Yeah, no, I mean, you agree, you're not in your age group's pop culture.
Well, what would you say to Miley Cyrus?
Well, how old is she?
I don't know, about 12.
Oh, okay. No, but I mean, yeah, so she's communicating to 16-year-olds? Is that what you mean?
Well, no, actually, probably even to older than that.
Okay, all right. So, but back to... All right, so...
Well, we went...
Are you writing?
Yeah, still writing.
You're still hanging out with Lieber Stoller. Which office is Lieber Stoller? That's...
They were on between 49th and 50th, right on Broadway. That building is still there today also.
Right, so you did Hal Fine, it was in the same building as Don Kirshner, and then there's a second building where there's Lieber Stoller. And is it called Lieber Stoller, that company?
Yes.
Okay. And what is Lieber and Stoller doing? Because they were big with Elvis, was it?
Oh, giant with Elvis and everybody else.
Right, so are they at the office or working at home?
They're wherever they want to be. You know, occasionally they'd be in the office, and a lot of times they wouldn't.
So they would... They'd be equal or greater than Don Kirshner's table?
Certainly equal, but in another respect, greater, because they were also writing and producing all the records for the Coasters, for the Drifters, for Benny King.
For the doo-wop becoming R&B stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they wrote all the songs. They wrote Stand By Me. They wrote Charlie Brown. He's a Clown. You know, they wrote...
They wrote for everybody then in the late 50s.
Everybody.
And that's more than Kirshner was doing.
Oh, he never wrote.
No, I mean his stable.
He not only didn't write, he didn't produce. His producer was his partner, which was Al Nevins.
Right, but they are not... They're not getting as wide-range types of music as Lieber and Stoller.
Well, yeah, they are, because remember, you know, you think about when you say wide range, Carole King wrote some R&B, you know, when you think about You Lost That Love and Feeling, that was through Kirshner, because that was written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil.
Right.
Neil Sedaka, you know, was a mainstay.
Yeah.
Over there. And so, yeah, there was...
There's so much music being made. Everybody's getting a third of it, if you think of the three groups.
Yeah, well, don't forget, though, you're leaving out one.
Motown.
That's it. You're leaving out Giant.
Yeah, now, so they're actually king for a while.
Who's that?
Motown.
Oh, more than a while.
Right, okay.
Oh, much more than a while.
Okay, so Lieber Stoller are the late 50s, then comes Motown, and Kirshner and Hal Fine are in between.
You better include Lieber and Stoller all the way through the 60s.
Oh, okay. Well, who were the main names other than those names for them?
Who are we talking about, Lieber and Stoller?
Yeah, that's Carole King. Burt Bacharach is with them?
Burt Bacharach had a partnership in one of their publishing companies. One publishing company was called Trio Music.
Yeah.
And then Burt Bacharach produced a lot of stuff and wrote his own stuff. And like I said, he wrote three songs for Jane the Americans, which were under the Lieber and Stoller banner.
Right.
And for that, they did a partnership. I'm talking about Burt Bacharach and Lieber and Stoller, and they opened a company called Quartet Music. So there was Trio Music, which was Lieber and Stoller alone. Then there was Quartet, which was a partnership between Burt Bacharach and Lieber and Stoller. And
Who were some other names besides Bacharach and King? I don't know if I would know them, that were major writers. Lieber and Stoller. We're in this table.
Oh, well, yeah, and she just passed away not too long ago. There was the husband-wife team of Jeff, and he produced the thing. He helped produce Children of the Night.
Which is a later thing in 81.
Ellie Greenwich. Yes. Ellie Greenwich and wrote with her husband, and I'm trying to remember his last name now, Jeff Barry.
Okay, and she just died?
Yeah, she died within the last year, I think.
You know, it reminds me, there's this woman, maybe Carol, who wrote for everybody. In my mind, she's based in L.A. Who's the one who wrote an incredible number of hits? I don't know if his name's Carol, but I just found out about her recently.
Not Carol Bayer, Sager.
I think that's it.
Is it? Okay.
Did you know her?
Yeah, but she didn't write anywhere near as many hits as Carole King.
Is that right? Carole King was incredible, you're saying.
Yeah, she didn't write anywhere near as many hits as Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. Jeff Barry, not with Ellie Greenwich, but with Peter Allen, wrote I Honestly Love You.
Mm.
And together, Jeff and Ellie wrote, Go into the temple and chapel, we're going to get married.
So all that great music, all these different groups, actually a small number of people wrote a lot of that.
Right. Wow. They also wrote, Vroom, Vroom, That's When I Fell For the Leader of the Pack.
Good dog. Yeah. Who wrote that? Ellie Greenwich?
There we go, walking down the street, singing doo-wah-dee-dee-doo-dee-doo-dee-doo. That was Jeff and Ellie also. They also wrote...
That's Ellie. You're saying that's Ellie.
Ellie and Jeff.
Okay.
Did it as a team. And they worked strictly for Lieber and Stoller.
How much did they get paid with these hits? Were they on a salary or a contract, or did they get...
You know what, I don't know that business, you know, what their advance might have been.
A lot of it was getting advance.
Yeah, because they knew the money was going to come in, but meanwhile, how do you live?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe at that time they might have each been getting a couple of hundred a week or whatever.
But they would have incredible royalties the last 20, 30 years, right?
Right.
Yeah. So they're millionaires.
Oh, they were. Well, she was, yeah.
Yeah.
I tell you, I actually remember a real quick side story. Jeff came into the Hyatt. I was working the Hyatt in Hollywood in 1981, and... he says, take a ride with me afterwards, and of course I got into a Rolls Royce. The thing that I remember, when I said, geez, this is a nice car, and he said, you know what, though? He says, I can't stand it anymore. Why not? And this is 1980, he said, because every time I take it in for just an oil change, it costs me anywhere between $1,000 and $1,500.
Why?
Don't ask me. I don't know.
The garage finds other problems?
I don't know about
right.
that. No, I just think everything that they do is so bloody expensive.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, so back to... So here's what's interesting. You actually are for a moment there, the flavor of the month, and you're performing, you're the new potential hit, and you're writing stuff. You guys were the pulse of the thing for a minute or two, right?
Yeah, you might say.
All within the industry, within New York City, so to speak. I mean, the masses don't know about this, but the world of New York City knows about you.
Right. Oh, we were doing real well.
The toast of the town.
Well, so to speak.
So who did you meet, which you recall, stars and celebrities and stories that come out of that period?
Well, there was an agent that came into the living room, and he was the biggest agent at the time. He had the most power. He also had under his belt as clients, Barbara Streisand was his client.
You mean Big Swifty?
No, not Swifty. Swifty Lazar was an agent if you were a writer in movies.
Okay.
And a producer and or actor.
Right.
But for television shows, for instance, Joe Glazer would get on the phone and I'm telling you now something that I actually witnessed personally where he would call Ed Sullivan and not tell him or ask him. He would actually shout at him, "She's on the show this week." And he was talking about Barbara Streisand at the time.
That was the beginning, her first time, you mean?
That was the first time for me. What he did was, he said, when he after he saw us, and by the way, this is a real cute story. The doorman at the living room actually thought that Joe Glazer was a chauffeur because he was wearing a cap and he was driving his Rolls Royce himself. And in the passenger seat, he brought in Louis Armstrong with him.
Wow.
So that,
so Joe Glazer is the king of writers? What is it?
Oh, he had the biggest, it was called ABC, American Booking Corporation. I still have that contract also that we signed.
Right. Okay. And what is he offering? Singers?
No, everybody. Singers, anything that he signs. And what he does is he books them into Las Vegas, all over the world.
Oh, okay.
He gets you television shows. He'll get you a Broadway deal, if possible, if it's in, you know, if it's appropriate.
So he's the king behind the scenes of the music business.
Yes, he was the king agent.
King agent and the key guy that the public doesn't know, right?
Well, probably not common knowledge, but...
I mean, the New York people would know because they
came
around.
Yeah, I mean, every common man wouldn't know Joe Glazer is the biggest, yeah, wouldn't.
So you saw him get Barbara on the show first, on Ed Sullivan's
first time?
Not the first time.
But that particular day that we went up to sign a contract with him...
He says, "Ed, here's who you're having on this week."
Right.
And that would be common. That's what he did.
That's what he did. He shouted at people. He just, you know, he was insistent. He was intimidating. He was...
Was he big?
Was who big?
Joe Glazer. I mean, physically.
He actually was a stocky man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't...
Bulldog.
Yeah, kind of. He wasn't that tall, but yeah, he was a stocky man.
And how long was he in that role? When did he start?
Oh, you know what? I think you'd have to Google him to know that.
Okay.
I don't know that.
But, I mean, he was big before you showed up.
Way before.
Yeah.
Of course, when I meet him, he's probably 65.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyways, we're talking about him because he signs you to do what?
He signs us to do to his agency. And then it was kind of really disappointing when the bookings that we did turned out, and he was, you know, his he don't call directly anymore. It's his henchmen that called, and all the agents that work for him, the sub-agents, and they say, "We got you 2 weeks in Cleveland." They put us on a tour. "We got you 2 weeks in Minneapolis, and we got you two." So it was the very first time was a six-week deal.
These are not Playboy clubs.
No.
These are just clubs.
These are clubs in the Midwest.
Okay.
And so they're described to us as being very much like the living room. And not one of them was. It was real disappointing.
You mean they were just...
They were regular...
Gummy.
They were clubs, but they were more clubs where people wanted to get up and dance.
Okay, they weren't... It's the next culture. It's not just listening to sing good singing kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, it's not a show. Type of entertainment. It's more, you know, where people can do both. And so we had to really quickly adapt. I actually had to start, not me, but my brother, had to actually start playing a drum. Yeah, it was real, as I say, real disappointing.
Because you had to do other kinds of music.
Yeah, and we had to play stuff that people knew, like Blue Moon.
Right.
You know, stuff like that.
And not what you thought that you would be marked out for.
Right, because by that time, we had learned and we had written other stuff and, you know, more of a satirical nature. You know, like Get Undressed for Democracy.
Yeah.
Pay Your Soul to the Multitude. We'll all find happiness if the world will just undress, be free, be equal, be nude. Okay, and there's a whole story behind that. But go sing that to some crowd where all the guy wants to do is grab the girl's ass that he's dancing with.
Right, right, yeah.
Maybe nude would catch his ear, but that would be it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I just Googled Joe Glazer.
Yeah.
And there's nothing on Wikipedia other than, look at this. After separating from Lil, Armstrong started to play at the Sunset Cafe for Al Capone's associate, Joe Glazer.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, then it says Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday demanded her manager, Joe Glazer.
Okay, look up American Booking Corporation.
Okay, but that, did you know that Joe was Billie Holiday's manager?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the guy.
Yep. He had personal contracts with a lot of people.
American Booking Agents?
No, American Booking Corporation.
Corporation.
Yeah, see that?
They have a picture of him. He looks like your typical sleazy mafia guy a bit in the picture, one of the pictures here.
Really?
Yeah, and a cliche old 40s picture, but American Booking Corporation, nothing really comes up.
Okay. How did you spell Glazer? Well, I guess you got
G-L-A-S-E-R.
It.
G-L-A-S-E-R.
I think it actually, you know, now I'm not sure, I seem to remember G-L-A-Z-E-R.
Okay, I'll put that in.
But maybe that has nothing to do if you already got the thing.
Yeah, it says Joe Glazer, June 79, a composer, musician. That's not him. So you go back to the S, and you said he was manager of Billie Holiday. That's G-L-A-S-E-R. They have that.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. I've now wikied Billie Holiday. See if Glazer is in her entry. There's one.
Well, I'm so surprised. I guess,
Yeah, listen to this. Ed Fishman, who fought with Joe Glazer to be Holiday's manager, thought of the idea to throw a comeback concert at Carnegie Hall. And that goes into March 27, 1948. And then the other Glazer is, Holiday demanded her manager, Joe Glazer, give her a raise shortly after. So he's mentioned twice in the Billie Holiday thing.
Right.
But
yeah,
there's nothing else on him.
Yeah, I see that. I don't know.
Oh, you're looking too?
Yeah, I see the same thing.
Yeah. Anyways, that's the guy that you're working for, and he put you in crummy clubs.
Yeah, it was real disappointing.
Well, maybe that's the point. He only had the mafia circuit.
I don't know.
I mean, he had the mafia circuit out there, but he had the big stuff in New York, but maybe it's a sleazier level, or just maybe there were no clubs out there like you expected.
No, what happened is also what really riled us, and that's when we decided we had to leave, is did you ever hear of Jackie and Troy, the duo?
Yes, that sounds familiar.
Okay, well, they were very good, and I liked them a lot. And what happened was, he said, oh, he says, I could have just put you, and that's really threw me into a tantrum, when we complained, and he said in a phone conversation, I could have put you at the Tropicana in Las Vegas. We'd never been to Las Vegas at that point.
But you're talking about Jack and Troy?
Jackie and Troy.
You're saying you got mad for them.
I got mad because he put them in when he said he should have put us in.
Oh.
In other words, we were not at the top of his list.
Even though he made a big deal out of you when he signed you, and that's what you're disappointed by. You're not getting any real thing that you think you'd get from him.
Right.
He's getting this B-level.
And you know what? That's exactly right. And that's actually, in hindsight, that's kind of common, or it happens often.
Yeah.
You know, it does happen often.
And now, is this the period when you do the Playboy clubs?
Right. This was the same period of time, because we're in the living room, and so Danny Siegel makes the deal with Shelley Caston from the Playboy Club, and we go there first. And that was a great experience because we got to meet Hefner, and we were invited. We had open house at the mansion every single night. We ate there every night. I mean, it was like unbelievable.
Did you get laid?
Yes, we did. I mean, I came back. I had to look for it in order to know it was there.
What do you mean?
I'm talking about my putts.
you mean you'd used it so much?
That's exactly.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yes, I did use it so much.
Well, let's go back when you were started to be at the living room. Oh, even when you're a writer, 61, 62, 63, do you get groupies because you're in the behind the scenes, or you don't get groupies? When you're just a writer, are you able to attract women?
Yes, because of the playing. Because not only am I doing club dates, I'm also doing clubs, like small clubs.
Right, right, and you're meeting people.
Oh, met a ton of people, piano bars. I got one story that is the most hair-raising story of all, and it's so unbelievable.
Go ahead.
Well, I worked a place, and one night this absolutely stunningly beautiful lady is in, and she chats me up, and I'm behind the piano, and I'm playing, whatever, and she just says afterwards, want to come back to my place. Well, how can I not do that?
Yeah.
On the way home, she says, oh, by the way, I have to stop, and I have to buy my dog some soup. So we get to her place, and she opens the bathroom door, and sure enough, there's a dog, and she puts down the soup. And then she gets into bed, and I'm wondering, you know, kind of, I don't know, something just is not feeling right to me.
It's too fast?
Well, yeah, it's too fast. It's, you know, it's just, it's, I don't know. And it was a hotel, you know. And it's the hotel that Johnny Carson always used to joke about. Do you know the Dixie Hotel?
Right, yes.
Okay. It was a real sleazebag place right on Park Avenue amongst all these ritzy places.
Right.
And here we are, in the midst of going through our, I'll call them machinations. How's that?
Yeah, yeah.
And the phone rings. Remember now, it's about 4:30 in the morning. I don't know why, but I just had this real bad feeling. I get up, I get dressed real quick, and I get in the elevator, go down, I close the light in the elevator, and as I come to the bottom floor, I see somebody is on a stairwell, and he's looking both at the elevator and up the stairwell. Well, he starts running up the stairwell, and I go out. Anyway, bottom line is, the next day, in one of the newspapers, that room had gotten shot up.
Wow. Well, were you in the bed with her?
Yes.
Were we having sex?
Yes.
There was no problem with her?
No.
But she was in the middle of a drama.
I would say that's a good way of
saying it. Yeah. I mean, but she didn't die.
You know what?
Maybe they didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, she did.
Really? You found out the next day?
Yeah, the whole room was riddled.
So this, somebody phones, she answers it, but you get out. You don't know what's going to happen on the phone.
Right.
Then you see some kind of drama is happening on the stairwell, and the guy's running around. They're getting ready to nail her.
Right.
Wow. And you found out the next day she died?
Yeah. And this was in the report. This was in the thing. And right before I left, she said, where are you going? And I said, well, what's that all about? She said, oh, she said, I was waiting for a job interview. Call back. And I said, at 4:30? And that's when I split.
Yeah.
Split out.
You didn't even say goodbye?
Yeah. In a manner of speaking.
Yeah. And you didn't tell her why you were leaving, just left?
Just left.
And she's dead shortly after?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Very shortly after. And, you know, and I thought for a very long time after that how that could have definitely been me.
Yeah, you would have been caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, so, anyway.
So that still haunts you? Every now and then you think of how close it was?
No, I really don't.
Yeah, you can say, well, that just shows you how protected I was.
Yeah.
So you could think good about it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, you weren't going to be taken out no matter what.
That is true.
Okay, so, but you're saying, I know you were out in 65, 66 with that Playboy circuit. How long are you doing it, and then you get disappointed because of Tropicana?
Is
it Tropicana? What am I saying? What's the name of the L.A. club? The Las Vegas club?
Yeah, that was the Tropicana.
Tropicana.
Yeah.
When do you find that out, that you didn't...
I don't know. I would say that we were with Joe Glazer about a total of maybe a year.
Okay, so this is the mid-60s, and meanwhile, Dylan's happening. You're aware of that. And his writing is going to change the music industry, right?
Correct.
So did that affect you?
No.
You didn't think you were in that world?
No.
You're already writing for, I don't know what you're... okay, so you're writing, and you're trying to get a hit, and then the Beatles come. That changes everything for American writers.
Yes, it did, because they wouldn't play anything else.
Right, so what did you write?
Well, I was still writing for other people, but not that much. I was really, at that point, from 64 on...
being a singer.
Right, we're writing mostly for ourselves. We're performing mostly, and we're doing some writing, and we're trying to get a record deal. And that's pretty much what we're doing until 1965, when we go out to open the Los Angeles Playboy Club.
Yeah, and that's when you told me you were by the Trip.
That's right, the Trip.
And tell that story. You go over there after the Playboy performance.
Yeah, I went in to listen to, I guess it was Smokey Robinson who was in there.
Yeah.
And I'm on a break in between shows at the Playboy Club, and I go in, I sit down, and Smokey says, stand up, you know, and I'm wondering who he's talking about. He says, come on, I know you're, whatever he said at the time, I don't know whether he said, I know you don't want to be, whatever he said, shy,
yeah,
or whether you, whatever it was, but anyway, I look around, and there's Dylan right behind me.
And how does he look to you?
He looked like Dylan.
That's when he had the wild,
yeah,
the rocker look.
Yeah, the frizzy hair.
Yeah.
And he stood up and he gave a high, you know, and sat down, and that was it. He said, blow it out the wind. He could have said out your ass, but he said, blow it out the wind.
Dylan said that?
No, only joking.
Oh, okay. But the thing is, are you meeting Motown singers and writers in this period?
No, not until... Not until, and it really wasn't so much singers, but it was, and I'll get the name in a second, my sister, but this is a few years later. There's a lot, it's actually more than a few years. It's, let me think of that for a second. It's quite a few years later. It's about 6 years later when my sister started going out with a staff writer of Motown, one of the very, very few...
regulars, you mean?
Regulars, and he's white.
Okay.
And he wrote, For Once in My Life, I Have Someone Who Needs Me, for Stevie Wonder.
Right.
And his first name is Ron, but I cannot think of his last name now.
Right.
So if you want to Google...
that song.
Yeah. For Once in My Life, writer Ron... Anyway, Ron becomes very interested in the three of us. At that point, my sister joined us in 1972. So it's about 1972 that...
She joined you in what sense?
We became a trio.
Oh, so you're still performing through the late 60s.
Yeah, and into through 70, actually through 75.
The Brothers Kane.
It was actually, we changed the name to the Kane Mutiny.
I remember that. Somehow, yeah. That's an album or something, or a song?
Yeah, we changed our name to the Kane Mutiny because it was now a trio, number one.
Right.
And we thought that was, you know, it was whatever it was. And so...
Is that C-A-I-N-E or C-A-I-N?
Yeah, just N.
Okay. Yeah, there was a movie, Kane Mutiny, with an E, I think.
Yeah, with Humphrey Bogart.
Okay.
Yeah, we did, and he. Okay, so.
So you're not writing as much.
Actually, maybe not as much, but well, we did write. We're not lots and lots, but for instance, in 1970, the two of us wrote the song that I told you was number one in Japan four times.
Right.
For a commercial, it started out as a commercial, but then became a commercial record.
Right. What was that song?
We wrote it as...
That's you and your brother.
Yes, just me and my brother. It's funny. We wrote... Well, anyway, it's called Mandem.
Mandem, okay.
Yeah. And then the Japanese put a surname on it, and I actually... I'm shorting out here all of a sudden. But I've got the 45, which I could look at. But anyway, it's called Mandem.
Right.
The World of. The World of Mandem.
And that's a commercial for some product.
Well, it's also a, it was a, it was, as I said, it was a number one hit four times. And, I mean, it's had this incredible life for the last 15 years, after nothing of 25 years.
Right.
After its initial play.
So who does it? If
well,
it's a hit four times, who's doing it?
Well, the first time it was number one, it was done by Jerry Wallace.
Right. Do you want to tell that story about how that was the comeback, or was that later?
Well, that was the comeback for who? For Jerry Wallace?
For Jerry, yeah.
Well, it could have been, but he acted real stupid because after the thing went to number one, Japan wanted him to do personal appearances, and they offered him an additional, I believe, two or maybe three fares and expenses for three other people, and he wanted 10.
Right.
And they scrapped the whole deal.
All right, so he did, does he get any kind of royalties?
I don't know what his deal is with the record company.
Okay, so he did it, then who does it next?
Next, it was done by, and I've got to get it, it's one of Japan's, I've got them here, but I've got to look at the names.
They're okay.
They're all Japanese artists, and one is Japan's, I don't know about this minute, but about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago when it came out, he was Japan's biggest actor.
Biggest actor, okay.
Yeah, so I've got to look at the name. It's the funniest. I'll need to play it for you. You get a big laugh out of it.
Yeah, now I'm thinking, okay, I purposely did a pause there.
Okay.
I have to actually talk to someone at 6, it's quarter to 6. I'm thinking, could you possibly require a break and we could do the rest? I mean, we're just sort of, I'd like to get what happens.
Yeah.
That's a big story. And that would be a whole another 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
So do you think we should take a break?
Oh, definitely.